The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
IMC. I talk some about the earthquake and the aftermath in Japan, because I felt, how could I talk about anything else? And today I looked at more videos of what happened in Japan, and how can I talk about anything else today? The videos today were, for me, were much more graphic than the ones I saw yesterday. I think maybe some of the more home, I don't know what to call them, but kind of this more amateur videos that were done were making their way out now to the media. We can see some of you probably saw it. And it's very moving to see it. And so it's one of those, you know, happens in people's lives, individual lives sometimes, that some kind of great tragedy befalls them, sometimes in a family's life, sometimes in a local community's life. But it's not that often we have something that really touches people all over the globe in this kind of massive way. And it's a kind of a very important time for people, for the world, for those who choose to really look deeply and confront the nature of human existence, what we're here for, what it's about, and what our fundamental orientation is, what is our role, what is our response, who are we in this world? I was, just a few days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who has a house he's going to retire to on the Big Island in Hawaii, very close to the volcano. I think maybe the village where she lives is called the Volcano Village. Anyway, and she bought that place to live to retire because of her kind of tremendous love for the volcano. And she was very excited because when I saw her, last week or recently, it had erupted. And she said that she wasn't there, but you know, it's a big event there. Everybody rushes over to look as close as you can, and it was erupted. The lava was bubbling up higher than it usually does. You know, it's like a spout, and I think she just feels this tremendous awe. This is a person who also loves to look at Hubble satellite photographs of deep Earth, deep space. And it's kind of awesome to look deep into the space and to see the great galaxies and planets and all this, you know, cosmic scale of things. It does something to people, I think, to kind of, for some people it's very hard not to somehow place themselves in the midst of it in some way or other. There was a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where Calvin is out at night looking at the great night sky and all the stars. And what does he say? He says something like, I am important. And great confidence yells it out to the stars. And then the little little picture, he's standing kind of looking kind of small, and he says, says this dust mote to the stars. Somehow that kind of oscillation, this pendulum from thinking he's really important to just hardly counts at all. And in the scale of, you know, looking deep into space, you know, where all these fiery stars are burning up and collapsing and doing their things, a little earthquake is hardly nothing. Or, you know, it's one thing to look at the volcano when you have safe distance, and there's another thing to be at Pompeii or to be at some place where lava comes pouring down into your village, as it does some places like the Philippines and places. And as I was looking at the images today, I mean, it's kind of awesome to see the power of the water as it washed across the landscape in Japan, and the tremendous force and energy of it, and the scale of what nature is possible to do, and how things that seem so significant or big for us in a human scale were just washed away as if they were just toys, you know, toys in the creek, and just kind of, I mean, it was quite moving to see these big towns just washed, literally, you watch them, you know, can't believe it. You know, you watch the water rush through the suburbs or the towns, and all the houses collapsing and being pushed off, like, you know, like a big bulldozer just kind of wiping them off. Quite something. And so it's hard to kind of sit there in awe of the power of nature and, wow, look at that. This is a planet we're in. Rather, when we see that and see the human side of it, it's more likely we feel horror or fear or sadness or something. The human capacity for empathy and to put ourselves in other people's shoes or see ourselves in them or, you know, somehow resonate with what's going on with them. And, you know, it was kind of heart-rending to kind of see what was happening there. And many things touched me deeply, but one of the things that touched me was, the video was videoing the water rushing through, destroying a whole town. And the video, and people were up on a hill so they could look down safely. So he was mostly looking at the water. At some point, he panned over to the side of the road up on the hill, and there were some people across the road, kind of away from not looking at it. And there was a 5 or 6-year-old girl who was in hysterics. And some grown-ups were trying to comfort her. And, you know, what is it to look 5 or 6-year-old and see it all wash away? I've talked to people who have had nightmares now at night after seeing some of these images in Japan. And then it's kind of amazing that it wasn't just way over there, but the tsunami came all the way here to California. And today I also saw, maybe some of you saw also, the video of the water going through Santa Cruz Harbor. And much smaller scale, but it's kind of dramatic to see the piers kind of just buckling up and popping up, and it's quite something. So what is it to sit and look at this? What is it to be present for it? What's the response? In situations like this, people often come to their religion and say, what does your religion have to say about that? And sometimes people question their religious belief and think, well, that's not relevant now. That's not helpful. That doesn't really, you know, it's fine to help, you know, mindfulness stuff is fine if it helps me kind of with stress reduction a little bit. But, you know, what does it have to do about the deep existential issues of life? You know, how to respond to these kinds of stuff? How does it make a difference in the world? Or how does it give us hope in a world where it seems like this can happen anytime? I'm regularly reminded how close we are to San Andreas Fault. As I said yesterday, for a number of years, we rented an auditorium in Portola Valley for our Sunday morning sittings that used to be a school, but they closed it as a school when they realized they built a school on top of the San Andreas Fault. So we had our sittings there on top of the fault. And so when does that go? And, you know, I kind of expect it to go. I think it's in some ways better to expect than to say, no, can't happen. Everything's safe. We're safe. I grew up, much of my growing up was in Europe, and it had a big impact on me. I was born in 1954, 9 years after World War II, but as I grew up in Europe, the stories and the leftover of this amazing war was still very much in the air, very much present. And the Vietnam War and all this stuff. So what does Buddhism have to say about it? How does it support us? Well, what does it mean for us? What does it teach us? And I think for me that one of the most important things about Buddhism is not that it gives us a teaching to explain it, to give us some understanding. Oh, just it's like this. Let me tell you how it is. It's like this. You know, and then, oh, that's how the world is. That's why these things can happen, or whatever. And then now I know. Thank God, now we can go back to television. Now I don't have to deal with it. Now I understand. Now I don't have to change my life any. Because heaven forbid that you change your life. As I said yesterday also, there's a scholarly book on Christianity in the West, and it applies to all religions, just happens to be about Christianity. And he talks about how in America that there are two ways that churches teach their religion. too general approach, very generally. Remember, this I think is relevant for Buddhists as well as anybody, this kind of thing. One is religious messages which are comforting, and the other is religious messages which are challenging. So what would you rather have? Would you rather have your religion be comforting or challenging? Well, for me, I get comforted when it's challenging. I would rather have it be challenging. So one of the things that Buddhism offers is not so much a teaching that explains it all. You can get that from Buddhism, but rather it offers to train you, to teach people to have a capacity to be present for these things. So we can be the witnesses and be present. And so something deep can happen from within us as a response to what goes on in the world. And so to teach us how to be present is a beautiful and wonderful thing, because it's very easy to turn away. It's very easy to avoid. It's very easy to ignore. It's very easy to get lost in our anxiety and our horror. It's very easy to get reactive in all kinds of ways and feel distress, to sink in the face of it, or be discouraged, or give up, or numb out. There's so many different possible reactions we have. Denial. The mindfulness, the practice, the training of Buddhism is to teach us all the ways in which we try to avoid being present for what is, so that we can and then learn to be present in a way that we don't get pushed around by it. Learn to be present in such a way that we don't get caught up in our reactivity. Fear doesn't get the upper hand. Hate doesn't get the upper hand. Our greed doesn't get the upper hand. These things can happen, but we're stronger than them. We have a capacity to be present. And so Buddhism offers us training, which is not an easy training. It's meant to be, I don't know if it's meant to be challenging, but it just happens to be challenging because we're humans. That it's challenging to really do this, to train ourselves so we can really meet the tremendous existential issues of human life that sooner or later are going to befall all of us. And I would say that Buddhism was designed to help humans deal with this level of tragedy, this level of what life is about. There's a lot of joy in Buddhism. There's a lot of emphasis on peace and wonderful feelings and all that, certainly, but not at the expense of ignoring or denying or not facing this life that we live. So we have this thing in Japan. And so how do we? What happens to us? How do we react? What gets the upper hand? What happens to you when you see it? Do you get frightened and then get lost in the fear? Do you get distressed? Do you get anxious? Do you get horrified? Do you get is it too much and you shut down and have nightmares? Do you get angry? Some people's response is kind of, in some ways, misplaced anger. I mean, anger, it's so difficult, so painful, that being angry is better. So now, maybe we can get angry at the people who built the nuclear power stations, because that's, that's one way of reacting. And so the simple act that we do when we sit down to meditate is a radical act, because we're sitting down to be present for what is. And in the course of a day, a course of a life, all kinds of things come through that simple act of sitting. And we learn to stay, keep our seat, and be present, and discover and see deeply what goes on. I believe that in the myth of the Buddha leaving the palace, one of the primary myths of Buddhism is that the Buddha was raised in a very protected environment of a palace. His father, his parents protected him from seeing what was really like in the world. He had all the comforts and pleasures of life, but saw none of the difficulties of life. And then when he was the tender age of 26, he finally left the walls of the palace and was shocked to see that there's old age, sickness, and death, which is kind of shorthand for seeing, the full extent of what this life can bring us, the tsunami of life. So in this myth, one of the things that's meaningful is that when he saw that, he saw this life, he didn't then retreat back to his palace. He didn't retreat back to his suburban life. and ignore the world, back to his comfort. He didn't retreat and ignore it. Rather, he entered into the world to face it. And some people say, well, he left everything behind to become a monk. But, you know, if you're going to enter the world to face existential issues in ancient India, it wasn't like there was welfare to help you out or food stamps. You know, you had to, you know, there was very little options if you really face it and deal with it and look at it. And the avenue that was available at the time was to be a renunciant. But I like to think that, you know, he actually entered into it to face it and deal with it. And I hope that that's what Buddhism is encouraging everyone to do, is to turn towards their difficulties, turn towards what's hard and difficult, and face it and learn from it and heal through it or find what's possible through it. So the first task, I think, is Buddhism, what it has to offer is it offers a whole, to develop our capacity to be present. And then when we have these kinds of events, like in Japan, hopefully then you have the capacity to stay present for it. I know there are some people who've turned the television off, they can't handle it, and so they just, that's too much, I can't deal with it. Which I can respect, that it's important to care for oneself, and that's one way. But I hope that we are training people here at IMC who turn off the TV when it's the soap operas, but turn on the TV when it's a matter of seeing this life that we have and really facing it and taking it in. And so have a capacity to see. So that's one thing. But then what happens when we see? What happens when we feel, when we have the empathy? What happens? How do we, what goes on? And one of the questions that I think some people ask is, am I obligated to respond? I want a religion that teaches me thou shalt be of service. You should, you know, this is what you should do. And one of the amazing things about Buddhism, as far as I can tell, is that Buddhism obligates no one to do anything. The way I read and understand Buddhism doesn't have any kind of obligation imposed or required of anybody at all. The moral teachings in Buddhism are guidelines, are suggestions, are pointers to a way of living that's harmonious and peaceful and doesn't cause trouble for you and your neighbors and people. It's a common sense. But you're not under any obligation to follow the moral precepts of Buddhism. Buddhism doesn't say you should be compassionate and go out and help those people. So if you hear that, and that's all you hear today, if that's all you remember, you're going to leave here and thinking, well, that's a kind of dud of a religion. That's kind of that's kind of cruel or cold-hearted. And these aloof Buddhists who are uninterested in the world, and you know, if people are compassionate and caring for the world, then of course they're obligated to go. And we kind of, some people demand obligation because it's so painful to face the world, so painful to see these difficulties, that the idea of being demanding and requiring is one response. You have to. Someone has to deal with this. Someone has to help. So, you know, and it's too painful not to get that kind of moral injunction. You have to respond. Or some, you know, I need teachings that tell me that. I want teachings. I want some overarching worldview that's going to teach me how to, you know, that's going to reassure me that there's some sense in all this or something. But Buddhism, as I read it, doesn't obligate us to do anything. But it doesn't leave us then, I hope, to do nothing. Or maybe in some ways Buddhism does leave us. But it leaves us to the workings of our own hearts. And the question is not what we're obligated to do in response, but the question is rather, do you listen to your heart? And so this capacity to be present and to hear and to see and to be open to and not to react against or close down towards, but stay open and relaxed. I think then, I believe that for most people, then that open heart will want to respond. And so we respond not because it's an obligation externally, but rather we respond because if we don't respond, if we don't act on that response, if we don't act on the heart's wish or impulse, I think we do a kind of violence to ourselves. We bottle ourselves up, we close something down. It's like if you're walking down the street and your friend trips and scrapes her knee or something and has a hard time getting up, you know, it's a pretty natural thing to reach out your hand and help the person up and say, what can I do to help you, or be concerned about the person. No one has to tell you to do that. It's just like, you know, it's so obvious. But, you know, but if you feel that impulse to help your person, they have trouble getting up, maybe they can't get up quite, you know, it's really painful and they're trying to get up, and you say, well, you know, I don't know what you might say, but you might, you know, hold yourself back and not let yourself follow that impulse. I think something then gets shut down or gets closed, or there's a kind of a something not good that happens in us. When something really big happens, like this thing in Japan, and we have the capacity to have the heart respond, I think the heart wants to respond. And so how does it respond? When we had 9/11 here 10 years ago, there were many people who were deeply moved by it, but I think not to have been changed by 9/11 is a kind of violence to oneself. To just kind of go back to life as usual, as if nothing happened, and not to somehow be changed by something like that, I think is a something's the heart hasn't been listened to deeply, because the heart responds, the heart wants to change. And so there's no obligation to do anything, but as we learn to be present and turn towards with calmness and equanimity, and then the heart's capacity for love, for compassion, for caring, has a chance to come forth. And I think it's a natural thing to respond and act on it. And I think if we do look for a Buddhist response, Buddhist idea of how to respond, the Buddhist response is listen to the heart and follow and act on it. Don't bottle it up. Don't deny it. Let it change you. Let it affect you. Even at the expense that you get uncomfortable, because the status quo gets changed, it means you have to move things around a little bit, and or a lot. So this points to kind of an image that I also gave yesterday of how do you, and you know, so part when we learn to be present for ourselves and see what's here and our reactions, we also learn what is the attitude that we have about who we are in relationship to the world. Do we feel like we are efficacious, that our efforts make a difference? Do we feel that it's okay to respond? Do we feel that, on the opposite of that, feel, no, I can't do anything. Actually, I'm not someone who can act on the world. I'm someone who's being acted on the world all the time. I'm a victim. Things are hard. I'm constantly fending off difficulties and problems, and you know, I don't, you know, just overwhelming for me. So what's the attitude and view, you know, that's deeply embedded in our psyche about who we are in a relationship to the world? So in this regard, then the kind of analogy that I like to give is that of, if a fly lands on an ant, it's a big deal for the ant. They're, you know, fly might even be bigger, big house flies bigger than a little ant, and ants are strong, but still. And so it's a big deal for the poor ant. But if the same fly lands on an elephant, the elephant couldn't care less. It doesn't affect the elephant. So many of us have problems. Sooner or later, there'll be challenges in our lives, all kinds of challenges. But do you respond to those challenges as if you're an ant, or as if you're an elephant? And I think that the training that Buddhism is giving us, the training of mindfulness, of presence, of compassion, of kindness, all the training to be present in an effective way, is not pointing to people becoming passive, you know, like meditation couch potatoes, meditative couch potatoes, meditative mushrooms that just sit there like, you know, calmly looking at whatever's going on. Mr. Natural, for those of you old enough, remember Mr. Natural cartoons. But Buddhism, I'm hoping, is training us to be elephants. And so rather than having our reaction, our reactivity, have our overwhelm, having our fear, having our hate, be the operating principle about how we're going to respond or react. The operating principle is that is the elephant who can respond, that you can act in the world, you can do something. And so the practice of mindfulness, the practice of Buddhism, I'm hoping makes elephants, makes empowered people, people who when they if they identify themselves as something, they don't identify themselves as the victim mode, but they identify themselves as someone who can act in the world. I don't know if we want to call them warriors, but the Buddha was a warrior. The warriors don't sit around and bemoan the fact that life is hard. I don't think, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, I don't think we need to go look for a metaphysical understanding or overarching understanding of the nature of the cosmos and the world and where we all fit in. That's just more of the kind of old mindset operating. But if we free ourselves of that, then it's enough. It's really enough, I believe. It's beautiful to respond. It's beautiful to feel like, oh, it's enough to respond. I don't know if I'll be effective. I don't know if I'll make a difference, but I can respond. I can act. I can do. I can try to make a difference in this world. And the world is made up of many examples of individuals and small groups of people who made a huge difference in many people's lives. The power of individuals, the power of people working together, do a lot. And so that's what I hope that the Buddhist response is that it makes us elephants. And so, in terms of Japan, what can we do? I think for right now it's hard to know what we can do from the distance, but I think one of the things we can do is we can donate money to the kind of organizations that specialize in doing disaster relief, like the American Red Cross. And there's a huge need for that right now, and I think that's something we can do. And then if we stay present, if we don't just simply forget this, I think over the next days and weeks we'll learn more and more about what's going to be needed. And what we can do. Some of us are not going to be, for some whatever reason, are not going to do anything directly for the Japanese. And so I'm often very moved to do something, to respond to the suffering I see in the world. But I can't do it all. None of us can do it, respond to it all. But one response I think that's very valid is to take the energy, the impulse to try to respond or do something, make a difference, and channel that energy to do what you do better. So if you're a teacher, one response to what happened in Japan is to try to teach your students better so that they become better citizens in the world. If you're make a difference in your corner of the world, to make it a better place for the people around you. And so you're affected by the international, but your elephant footprints are local. That's where you affect it. So I've talked too long. I apologize. I meant to have more time for you. I would like to maybe, some of you have something you want to say about the events in Japan, or your reaction, your response, your thoughts about it, or what I've said, or anything you like. If you can wait for the mic, all the way in the back. Go ahead, yes. You have to see a green light, wait, Cheryl. Yes.
I haven't been watching too much coverage, but one thing it seems I haven't heard is much about looting and people's taking things from other people. My understanding is Japan is a very homogeneous society and they take care of each other. And if it is true there hasn't been any looting, that is, to me, is very amazing, because I think in other places where there are people struggling, that they do tend to take from each other.
Yeah, I've heard I've heard in the last couple of days of people standing in long lines very politely waiting for rations, waiting for food, I've also kind of very touched. I was touched by it when I heard of, I think it was a woman who was pulled out of some wreckage, and she apologized for causing trouble for the rescuers. Cheryl.
Yeah, I saw one thing. Yeah, where they were all in line, and they were, they were only allowed 10 items each to buy, and yeah, everybody was obeying that. You know, nobody was getting excited or stealing.
Yeah. So, yeah,
I thought that was very incredible.
Yeah,
and a model for something else too.
It's a beautiful thing
to do.
So Cheryl.
I was going to say something similar to that, which I had heard on PBS. But another ironic thing is we're talking about IRC, and the first thing I thought of was International Rescue Committee, because they are known as a very good charity as far as, you know, really doing what they say they're going to do. And I got an email tonight, but I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. So in addition to IRC, the Retreat Center, people could look at that website and see what they're saying, because I think it might be useful. Insight Rescue, International Rescue Committee.
Great, thank you.
I remember you gave us a talk about Burma, what happened in Burma, and you said that, I remember, we can start doing things here. You know, we can take care of what's happening there, but here. And every day, things can happen, and you see someone that needs help, and you jump in, and that's what we can do now.
Yeah, I can tell you, I wouldn't underestimate that importance of that. You have to look at your heart and see what works for your heart.
With the events also, it's a respect of nature, something bigger than when I saw the waves coming in the videos, and I realized how deeply I have to respect nature every day, and it's almost like it's our duty to do that. So that's something to think about.
Better be respectful of it. Yes. So you want to wait? You want to wait for this so people can hear you?
It's on.
I was very moved reading in the newspaper about the kids from this one school. Somehow they got mobilized. I think this one boy and this family wanted to do something. So the kids in the school went out to different big companies, and they went in there and asked for donations. And I thought, my God, at their time of life, to be doing something like that, I thought, it's going to make a big change in their life this early. And I thought, here I am. I didn't even have a thought like that. But look at the kids.
Beautiful, yeah. Thank you. So then, one of the interesting coincidences, small ones. So yesterday, you know, I gave this talk on what was going on in Japan, but yesterday also we had canceled a special event we were going to do after the regular Dharma talk on Sunday morning. We're going to do this, what was called the launching party or launching kind of presentation of of the Inside World Aid, which is a nonprofit some people in our community have created, coming out of our community, to be able to go abroad to places like Cambodia and do medical missions and try to help people there. And so, you know, we tried to get the word out that we canceled it, and I was going to give some talk about something completely unrelated. And then, so we still canceled this launch of this new nonprofit. But the whole Dharma talk was about, you know, was closely connected. So some of you might be interested over the next years, some of us are going to develop this Inside World Aid kind of organization to go do interesting work around the world in places. So, some of us are baby elephants, but I hope we all become elephants. So, anyway, thank you.